Chapter 14. Railway Border Industrial Corporation. He was running a man. A success would have pleased him very much on refreshingly novel grounds. But, on the other side of the same feeling, it was incumbent upon him to cast it off utterly at the first sign of failure. A man may be thrown off. The papers had unfortunately trumpeted all over the land his journey to Costaguana. If he was pleased at the way Charles Gould was going on, he infused an added grimness into his assurances of support. Even at the very last interview, half an hour or so, before he rolled out of the patio, hat in hand, behind Mrs. Gould's white mules, he had said in Charles's room, "You go ahead in your own way, and I shall know how to help you, as long as you hold your own. But you may rest assured that in a given case we shall know how to drop you in time." To this, Charles Gould's only answer had been, "You may begin sending out the machinery, as soon as you like." And the great man had liked this imperturbable assurance. The secret of it was that to Charles Gould's mind these uncompromising terms were agreeable. Like this, the mine preserved its identity, with which he had endowed it as a boy, and it remained dependent on himself alone. It was a serious affair, and he, too, took it grimly. "Of course," he said to his wife, alluding to this last conversation with the departed guest, while they walked slowly up and down the corridor, followed by the irritated eye of the parrot, "of course, a man of that sort can take up a thing, or drop it when he likes. He will suffer from no sense of defeat. He may have to give in, or he may have to die tomorrow, but the great silver and iron interests will survive, and someday will get hold of Costaguana along with the rest of the world." They had stopped near the cage. The parrot, catching the sound of a word belonging to his vocabulary, was moved to interfere. Parrots are very human. "Viva Costaguana," he shrieked, with intense self-assertion, and, instantly ruffling up his feathers, assumed an air of puffed-up somnolence behind the glittering wires. "And do you believe that, Charlie?" Mrs. Gould asked. "This seems to me most awful materialism, and, my dear, it's nothing to me," interrupted her husband, in a reasonable tone. I make use of what I see. What's it to me, whether his talk is the voice of destiny, or simply a bit of claptrap eloquence? There's a good deal of eloquence of one sort or another produced in both Americas. The air of the New World seems favorable to the art of declamation. Have you forgotten how dear Avellanos can hold forth for hours here?" "Oh, but that's different," protested Mrs. Gould, almost shocked. The allusion was not to the point. Don Jose was a dear good man, who talked very well, and was enthusiastic about the greatness of the San Tome mine. "How can you compare them, Charles?" she exclaimed, reproachfully. "He has suffered, and yet he hopes. The working competence of men which he never questioned was very surprising to Mrs. Gould, because upon so many obvious issues they showed themselves strangely muddle-headed. Charles Gould, with a careworn calmness which secured for him at once his wife's anxious sympathy, assured her that he was not comparing. He was an American himself, after all, and perhaps he could understand both kinds of eloquence if it were worthwhile to try, he added, grimly. But he had breathed the air of England longer than any of his people had done for three generations, and really he begged to be excused. His poor father could be eloquent too. And he asked his wife whether she remembered a passage in one of his father's last letters where Mr. Gould had expressed the conviction that God looked wrathfully at these countries, or else he would let some ray of hope fall through a rift in the appalling darkness of intrigue, bloodshed, and crime that hung over the Queen of Continents. Mrs. Gould had not forgotten. "Why, you read it to me, Charlie," she murmured. "It was a striking pronouncement. How deeply your father must have felt its terrible sadness. He did not like to be robbed. It exasperated him," said Charles Gould. "But the image will serve well enough. What is wanted here is law, good faith, order, security. Anyone can declaim about these things, but I pin my faith to material interests. Only let the material interests once get a firm footing, and they are bound to impose the conditions on which alone they can continue to exist. That's how your money-making is justified here in the face of lawlessness and disorder. It is justified because the security which it demands must be shared with an oppressed people. A better justice will come afterwards. That's your ray of hope. His arm pressed her slight form closer to his side for a moment. And who knows whether in that sense even the Santome mine may not become that little rift in the darkness which poor father despaired of ever seeing? She glanced up at him with admiration. He was competent. He had given a vast shape to the vagueness of her unselfish ambitions. Charlie, she said, you are splendidly disobedient. He left her suddenly in the corridor, to go and get his hat, a soft, gray sombrero, an article of national costume which combined unexpectedly well with his English get-up. He came back, a riding whip under his arm, buttoning up a dogskin glove. His face reflected the resolute nature of his thoughts. His wife had waited for him at the head of the stairs, and before he gave her the parting kiss he finished the conversation. What should be perfectly clear to us, he said, is the fact that there is no going back. Where could we begin life afresh? We are in now for all that there is in us. He bent over her upturned face very tenderly, and a little remorsefully. Charles Gould was competent, because he had no illusions. The Gould concession had to fight for life with such weapons as could be found at once in the mire of a corruption that was so universal as almost to lose its significance. He was prepared to stoop for his weapons. For a moment he felt as if the silver mine, which had killed his father, had decoyed him further than he meant to go, and with the roundabout logic of emotions, he felt that the worthiness of his life was bound up with success. There was no going back. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.